Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Stack Overflow podcast, a place to talk all things software and technology. I am Ben Popper, Director of Content here at Stack Overflow. Today, I have an episode for you about the way in which generative AI is changing the legal industry, what it means for lawyers, and what is a very big business across many, many countries and across the globe. I have an interesting relationship with this question, and then I have a friend who's a working trial lawyer who has very strong opinions on AI. We've argued about it quite a bit over the years, and I'll share some of those tales with you. Our guest today is Mark Doble, who is the CEO over at Alexi and brings some strong opinions on lawyers needing to embrace generative AI or be left behind. So Mark, welcome to the Stack Overflow podcast.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
So, you know, this podcast is kind of aimed at the world of software developers, engineers, CIOs, CTOs. Do you yourself have a technical background at all or just coming from the world of law?
I studied science and philosophy in my undergrad, and throughout, I was a little bit later, but throughout my undergrad, that's when I fell in love with programming. And during law school, spent about half my time building stuff, the other half doing the readings. And
Nice. So what kind of, were you building apps for yourself? What kind of tech stack were you using back then?
I started as a Rails programmer. It was a great entry point for me. And really it started as a huge creative outlet, that the power of code to create and build things. And that's what really drew me in.
Yeah, Rails is a language that a lot of people love, that some startups made the commitment to go along with because it was the most popular thing at the moment. And they've stuck with it, maybe not regretted it. Although these days, I think it's difficult to hire Rails developers because not a lot of new people are picking it up, unfortunately. But a language that,
right.
I was a tech reporter from 2010 to 2018. And so lots of folks at the time were deep in that world. All right. So you've got some background in the world of programming for yourself, learning that and dabbling, but you're also getting your JD in Canada. Is that any different from in the United States? So in the United States, typically you go to undergrad, then you go to law school, then you pass the bar exam, then you're admitted to practice. Is that how it works in Canada as well?
The exact same. Yeah. The only difference is that we have there's 3-year law school and then a year kind of a practical training, similar to like what a clerkship would be, but they also happen within law firms. So,
and so did you spend any time at a law firm? I checked your LinkedIn. It looks like you went from university right to Alexi. So is there a gap there? You did 1 year of practice or this sort of, what do I want to call it? It's not interning, but...
It's called articling. It's in Canada, articling. It's called articling. Yeah. So like clerkship, articling. So I did that and then a little bit of practice at the same firm. I got just enough to know what the practice of law was like, and in particular litigation, which is what I was most interested in. Enough to know what it was like, not enough to constrain my thinking in any way. I think I was still able to think outside the box. And so I had just enough of it, I think, to allow me to innovate.
Okay. So CEO of Alexi starting in 2017, were you also a founder at this company?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. So 2017, let's jump back in time. Nobody's talking about generative AI. No GPT system of any kind has showed off the ability to, you know, reason over language. 2017, 2018, this is like transformers are just being invented, right? You know, deep learning is showcasing some amazing skills. It's beating people in Go. It's beating people in poker. I used to write about it all the time. And the thing I always used to say was, it's amazing and it's a little bit startling that it can, you know, beat people in these games that experts told us it would never beat them in. But think about it like, you know, Deep Blue and Garry Kasparov. This AlphaGo is amazing at Go. It cannot play chess. It cannot write a poem. It's brittle. It's narrow. You know, it's deep in one direction. In 2017, what was your thought of, hey, I enjoy law. I've gotten a taste of it, but really I want to do technology. What was your company predicated on at the founding?
Well, it was abundantly clear that the rate of improvement in AI was so fast that every year we were clearly on this exponential curve of improvement. And it was right around that 2017, 2018 time when the first Transformer papers came out, right? And it was this being able to predict the next word. There seemed like a very credible path towards full narrative drafting of text. And that was super exciting. And it was clear the potential in the legal field was significant. There was still a huge gap at that time, obviously, and still in some ways today, between what the technology could do and what lawyers needed, these industry grade requirements. And so really the founding thesis was, let's try and build an AI that knows the law. And if we do that, there'll be lots of applications throughout the legal field. we knew that these foundational models, the underlying technology was going to continue to improve and allow us to do more and more. We were a bit early 2017, and it wasn't really until 2020 when we actually raised the first round of capital and got the company going. We had some customers, we had some idea of what the initial products needed to look like, and we were getting initial technical team, products teams together, but it really wasn't until 2020 when we started to have more of an impact.
All right. Well, this is interesting maybe for some of the developers and you know, hopeful entrepreneurs listening. How'd you survive those 3 years in the wilderness? Were other people working other jobs? Do you have some friends and family funds? Or, you know, it sounds like, right, you have a few customers, you're iterating on ideas, you've got pilots going, but you haven't latched on to that product market fit. So what were you doing?
We scraped together, I think it was maybe like $50,000 that myself and I was building the entire product myself. And then
in Rails,
exactly. Okay. And it was, I mean, there were some like NLP components at the time, but, right. There was no application for large language models or anything yet.
Right.
That came shortly after, but even then there was some sort of NLP stuff that we could do. We could do some sort of retrieval, some basic search to help get a product running. And we began in legal research.
Right.
So we had a Python backend that I was still maintaining, a Rails product, horrible decisions being made early on from a technical architecture perspective, but that's what we were doing. And yeah, it was, we were getting some revenue, getting some customers. It was pretty tough to raise any sort of money at that time. We went through Techstars, and then that got another couple hundred thousand dollars in equity that we raised. And then we were trying to validate a little bit more. We made the mistake of mainly starting in Canada with customers. And now about half of our customers are Canadian, half are US. The US is growing a lot more than the Canadian side, but really getting that commercialization proof points in the US was critical, and that we waited far too long to do that.
Gotcha. All right. Well, I won't make any comparisons between Canada and the US. That's not my bag. I'll let you do that. I guess, yeah, you know, it's interesting. You said there were some NLP, libraries or connections or, you know, ways you could tap into that. Now, obviously, we live in a world where you often go in and they say, you have your choice of 5 foundation models. And, you know, like you have your choice of 3 sizes of each and, you know, pick the one that suits you for speed versus inference cost versus, you know, X, Y, and Z. But let's focus in a little bit, I guess, on, yeah, that turning point. Once this technology started to mature, you know, once we saw the sort of explosion of its intelligence and capabilities in November of 2022, what did you hone in on? You know, what is the sort of key product offering you have now to customers, and where do you see the most traction?
Well, that it was really interesting for us. So even in 2020, when we had our first real product that was working, it was essentially a RAG implementation. But we would do retrieval, but then it was an extractive summarization model. So we would retrieve primary law, case law, legislation that was responsive to a question, and we had retrieval models that were pretty good, not nowhere near like they are today, but pretty good at identifying relevant answers, cases that were responsive to questions. And then we would use extractive summarization models to present an answer in like an essay or a memo-like format, similar to what you would get from ChatGPT today, although these were like 10 to 20 page documents. And even at the time, it was clear to us that general search, open domain search, a huge chunk of that could shift to this user experience, where instead of getting a list of links that the user now has to go and review, it was way easier to just summarize the content in each of those links and present it in a coherent answer to the user.
Right. Yeah, I mean, law is one of the fields where it seems like these large language models could have the most utility, because often what you're doing is taking on a case with potentially an enormous amount of case law that you need to search through to find the needle in a haystack that will help you, and or enormous amount of documents that you need to search through. And so, you know, a system that's capable of understanding, synthesizing, and then not just that, but annotating and pointing you to the ground truth is incredibly valuable. So many people in their first X years at a large law firm, their job is to sit in the room with 50 cardboard boxes and go through all the documentation that, you know, the opposing counsel sent over and see if they can find things, you know, that will be critical. Or, yeah, to read through 50 years of case law in a new state that they're going to see if, you know, a new territory, new jurisdiction, to see if there's something practical, you know, that can be applied if, you know, they don't feel like they have an understanding of the argument that they're going to win on based on the simple facts, right? So is that where your applications just, you know, sort of was first applied to case law or to documentation?
It was research. So primary law, which includes case law, legislation, regulation, making sense of this huge corpus of content, which serves as the source of law. Where do we find what the law is? And it's these primary sources of law. So really it was questions about what the law is and right. Using AI to dig through all of this, this corpus of content to mm-hmm. surface an answer. And yeah, so at that turning point when, certainly when ChatGPT was launched and we had access to GPT 3.5 APIs, it was certainly a significant turning point in a number of respects in how we thought about the technology. And it wasn't until probably another 6 months after the launch when RAG became much more mainstream. And it's like, oh, this is actually what we've been doing for the past 2 years right. now. We've been doing...
Did you call it RAG?
We didn't. We had no idea that that's what it was, but that's exactly what we were doing. And the big change really was that, so we had these Siamese encoder models, these retrieval models, right? We had generative models that would generate questions on case law. And then we would train these Siamese encoder models to do retrieval really well. So on these generated questions on case law, we'd have 20, 30 million pairs of these question answers to train this retrieval model. And we spent a lot of time, we had a team of very smart AI scientists doing this work to get these recall scores higher, right? You get every percentage point improvement in recall. And then we realized that, you know, if we have almost 100% recall in the top 5,000 documents, right? Why don't we just apply some sort of agentic flow to now filter down from these 5,000 to the 10 documents that were really needed? Mm-hmm. So instead of spending months trying to improve the recall score through improving training this retrieval model, and if the latency tolerance is high enough, you just make another 100 LLM calls and to validate, and you improve. Let's not spend any more time trying to improve this retrieval model. Let's right. just add some agentic element. We didn't even call it agentic elements at the time either. It was just like, let's just add a few more LLM validation calls here
right.
to improve the quality. Does this case actually respond to this question or no? If no, okay, get it out. Let's go on to the next one. You know, and so right. it totally transformed how we even thought about retrieval. There's an initial retrieval that's required, but after that, it's like, let's leverage the power of these models to validate outputs. And then it turned all these things that we know of now, scaffolding, chain of thought, all of these concepts that that emerge naturally through the inherent power of the technology. I think they're quite obvious concepts to people now.
So for like a Siamese encoder, just so folks understand, you're trying to ask it, you know, is there something within legal text we need, a precedent or within this document that matches what we're looking for, you know, that establishes there's some case law here where a ruling used the same language or had the same set of facts? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So they're basically, if you look at questions about primary law, about case law, and then the passages that answer that, they, if you look at the vector representations of these two cases, they actually live in fairly different worlds. And so you train these Siamese encoder models to map from question vectors to answer vectors. And so it brings them together, these models, so that when you have a question coming in, you're not looking really for passages that have the exact same words because they rarely do, right? It's right. different words that are used to answer the questions. And so these are the still, I believe, state-of-the-art retrieval models today, but it's just far more powerful to really leverage the LLMs. They are large language models just without the generative head on
them. Gotcha. And so, yeah, you mentioned, right, like it became possible to start deploying these agentic workflows. It became possible to, let's not call it brute force, but, you know, sometimes say, look, we don't need to improve the capability anymore. We can, you know, now work with a certain level of quantity instead. And I guess, was there also something different that you found in terms of the capabilities once we got to GPT 3.5 and above, where you said, okay, now we can, you know, there's different applications that are now possible given the sort of increased ability to reason over language?
Oh yeah, immense. It certainly wasn't immediate. It's taken a fair bit of time. It also, I think there was even maybe about a year ago where it wasn't clear, like, do we need to do some of this foundation model training ourselves? Like, is this where our company is going to have any sort of proprietary advantage going right. forward? Do we need to do it just to have some differentiated moat, you know, in the market? And so it took us quite a bit of time to figure that out, like what we needed to do, what we didn't need to do. And I think where we're at today is that similar to this, do we spend time improving this retrieval model, or do we just try and implement this agentic concept of, well, let's just make another 100 LLM calls, assuming the latency tolerance is there, the user is okay to wait a couple minutes for a memo to get, or an answer, or whatever it is.
Right.
This approach now, which we're heavily leaning into, these concepts of chaining potentially hundreds of LLM calls together for a single task or function for a user. Also, this idea of scaffolding, having models, validating the output of other models, and then tool use, you know, being able to go and run Google searches to find content that you might have missed. All of these things now are just incredibly powerful and have completely opened up the possibility of what we can build for our users. We do not need to be doing any sort of pre-training. Even fine-tuning is not really a thing that we do very much anymore. Maybe if we are trying to reduce some latency in some area on a very narrowly defined task, we might do some fine-tuning. But by and large, it's let's just put all of these pieces together to build incredible value for our customers.
Right, right. That's interesting. Yeah, I guess I would have initially assumed, right, you see what's happening, you think, oh gosh, we're going to have to build our own, you know, sort of legal specific, you know, foundation model and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But then you see, okay, great. These capabilities at the foundation level are almost becoming commodified. There's open source versions of them, you know, and they're getting cheaper and their tokens you're allowed to use are, you know, increasing. But okay, maybe we'll do fine tuning. Like, you know, then there'll be us, you know, not even that. Like, this is good enough on its own. Like, what we need to do is figure out the practical applications for our clients and like box that in, almost productizing, right? Like what's happening. So yeah, I guess let's dive into that. Now that you have these capabilities, what are the areas that you find the most traction? Like, what are clients doing with this day to day? Actually, let's level set for a second. For people who don't know, how prevalent is this kind of technology in the legal world? And then for your company, you know, like how many clients do you have actively using it? And then we'll just dive into what they're doing with it day to day.
Yeah, well, there's several companies out there that are doing something similar. Right. I think legal research is a very difficult problem. I think there's very well-funded startups. There's the Thomson Reuters of the world also famously acquired Casetext shortly after GPT-4 was launched. Casetext had early access and they've co-counseled, they've integrated into the Thomson Reuters products. But I mean, what we see from our customers and in the market is that, so one of the things is that with these generative models, I think it obscured the real problem in research, which is retrieval. People thought that generative models solved all the problems for legal research. They certainly didn't. You still had to retrieve the right sources that answered questions and present that in the right way, which you can do with retrieval models. But there are still famous examples from LexisNexis, which is a huge company in the legal research space, of citing cases that were published in the year 2025, which obviously don't exist, right? And so this hallucination problem that has been long solved for us, we do not have even a tiny percent of hallucination issues in our products. So I think it's been largely overstated how easy it is to do legal research really well with these technologies. And we haven't seen another company who does it anywhere near as well as we do. It's certainly not our long-term advantage. It's still kind of our wedge into the litigation space. And now we're applying similar approaches, similar technologies to things that you talked about earlier, really understanding the evidence of the case. There's
right.
a lot of cases, thousands, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of documents of significant length that lawyers need to sift through to understand what might be relevant, how to plan the case, how to strategize, what are the legal issues we really should focus on, mm-hmm. all of these things. So it's the facts and the law that we really combine to apply the technology to make the lawyers understand.
So let's get back to that claim you just made about hallucination. In what way are you able to completely avoid that? I guess you said you're not really using the generative side of these things. You're only using them in sort of a search and recall kind of way?
So the way we think about it is, are we using the intelligence or the knowledge built into the model? The more we rely on that, the more likely we're to get these hallucinations. And we broadly define hallucinations as errors, provable errors that are asserted with confidence. Their truth is asserted with confidence by these models. So if the model says, yes, this is definitely true, but it turns out to be false, that would be a hallucination. If instead the model says, this might be true, we're not totally confident, and it turned out to be false, we probably wouldn't call that a hallucination. Because maybe the user, somebody needs to go verify, and maybe nobody has done that. And so it wouldn't necessarily be wrong to say that this might be true. So it's really the combination of asserting something is true with high confidence that is a hallucination. And so definitely referencing cases that don't exist would be a hallucination. Right. The way we get around this is, one, only relying on the model's knowledge, built-in knowledge, which is incredible in many ways, but only relying on it when we can be confident that it's going to be accurate, and also giving the model room to say, I don't know the answer to this. Mm. If you force a model to answer a question, it's going to make something up. If you give it room to say, yeah, I'm actually not that confident, then it's far less likely to make things up.
So is that a matter of prompt engineering, of telling the model, like, listen, I want you to look, and then I want you to assess, and then I want you to form a confidence score, and then I want you to, you know, reply, you know, based on that? Is it also, I've seen, you know, versions of this where, again, there's like an agentic workflow, like send it to one, yeah, they read the data, send it to a validator, they make a check, send it to a judge, you know, or they pass it on, or send it to a, you know, a QA kind of process. Right. Which one, how are you doing that?
Well, certainly the prompts, the way the prompts are written is important, but what's far more important on the overall output is the series of LLM calls that are linked together and how they're validated, the testing that is done at each stage. You know, if you test things enough and you get to a certain threshold of confidence, then it's very unlikely that the model is going to make a mistake in the future. And so testing appropriately at each stage, it's the combination of all the models in the right way, looking for the right output, validating at the right steps, that's far more sensitive to the overall output than the specific drafting of an individual prompt. Certainly that's important, but it's really the architecture, the building of the agent and the workflow that from input to eventual output.
Today, you have clients in both the US and Canada, large law firms as well as small boutique ones. Is this mostly used just by bigger players who, you know, have a need to, like, they probably have a team of first years for whom a lot of this work, you know, would be done? Or who's using this? What do your clients look like? And then, yeah, on a practical day-to-day basis, like, where do you see them using it most and what applications?
Yes, we're focused on mid-market and below. So the the AM Law 100, the enterprise law firms, that's not our focus at all. There's very specific requirements for these firms that make it much more difficult to build a business around. And even just the sales cycles, the process of selling to these firms is far more difficult. We have repeatedly seen sales cycles of a couple of weeks, and these are still great contracts that come in really quickly. And we have a PLG motion that does not work in the enterprise. PLG is super important for understanding the product, getting really quick feedback cycles in the product. And so mid-market and below, and there's thousands of lawyers that use our product on a daily basis. Right. With recent updates now, we're at repeat daily use.
So even an independent practitioner, you know, could sign up at a consumer, you know, small business cost and use it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, $150 a month is our smallest plan. That's only for solo lawyers that running their own file, may not have any staff at all. And
interesting.
And there's a 7-day free trial. You know, it's pretty typical PLG motion that we have.
That's cool. Yeah, I had assumed, you know, I think because of my friend who I mentioned, and I think they brought on Harvey at his firm, and, you know, like, just I was thinking more about it right at that level that you're sort of saying, where it's like, it is very regulated, it's very bureaucratic, the, you know, the cases themselves are, you know, global in nature or whatever. And so, right, I can see that being a bit more difficult. But if you focus in on, okay, we understand US and Canada case law and, you know, precedent, and we have practitioners who are doing X, Y, and Z, now there's quite a number of those clients we could go after. So are you offering them access to any kind of like database, documentation or information that your model is searching that they may not have access to, or just, you know, what's already publicly available and what the models have trained on or and what they give it? I guess, do they upload documents?
Yeah, so it's a combination of all of the above, and we've got many licenses in place to be able to get access, bulk access to this content. It still is a bit of a challenge to get bulk access to everything, but that's changing very quickly. And so we worked really hard to get the licenses in place that we needed to confidently provide the product and the service to our customers. But yeah, also users are uploading content, uploading cases. And we do have various other strategies. As I mentioned, there's lots of real-time Google searching that's done as part of several agentic workflows that that we rely on to pull in content as needed.
I guess now I want to ask the question that I think is in the back of every software developer's mind, which is, what does this mean for my career as a lawyer? So, you know, hypothetically speaking, what does this mean for my career if I'm still in law school? What does this mean for my career if, you know, I want to, right, get a junior, very junior role at a 10-person law firm in my town? And the way I would have cut my teeth is doing exactly this kind of documentation research, and then, you know, eventually moving up to be part of a trial or more of a partner. Like, what role does the very junior human have when LLMs are honestly better at a lot of this stuff now?
Yeah, so what we've seen is in recent years is there's been a pretty important turning point in legal technology generally, I would say, from previous versions being limited to making firms a little bit more efficient, which is not the best incentive for them to adopt these technologies, just being a little bit more efficient. But now it's very clearly making lawyers significantly better at their job.
Right.
And that shift has had a really important impact on the market. And I would say, I mean, certainly there's so much unmet need of legal services within
right.
broader society that there's very limited risk, very little risk, I would say, to somebody losing their job. The real risk is if you're not actively learning how to use these tools, how to incorporate these tools.
Right. You're in the AI is not taking your job, someone with AI is taking your business camp.
There's definitely a part of that. It's all about timing. It's really hard to predict 20 years, 30 years from now, you know, like certain jobs might be eliminated, you know, but I do think there's something fundamentally human about the rights and liabilities of other humans that, you know, if aliens landed on Earth today, we probably wouldn't let them be lawyers, no matter how smart they were, because we can't be confident that their interests are perfectly aligned with, you know, somebody being accused of a crime or somebody being sued for hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, why would we let an alien who doesn't really know what it's like to be a human represent and determine the outcomes of that case? And I think having human professionals as at least intermediaries with the legal system, I think, is pretty critical for the next little while. But again, it's all about timing, and it's very hard to predict the timing.
Right. Also, to become a lawyer, you have to move through a pretty well-gated set of academic and then judicial, you know, gates. Can't practice, you know, in the United States, in different states even, you know, without having gotten permission for various reasons. And I do think, right, it seems like we're pretty far from me sitting down with a robo-lawyer and having them defend me. You know, that's a little bit distinct from, you know, fewer first-year research associates getting hired or whatever the answer may be. To get to Jevons' paradox, like, I understand, you know, like, there's plenty of legal work out there, and maybe this just means more one-person shops are available in every town, and that means more people can get cheap legal representation. And the answer to that is great. Like, nobody's representing themselves or working with an exhausted public defender who can't manage, you know, 15 cases at once, or every public defender now can manage 15 cases at once. Like, great, you know, that person is a 10x lawyer now.
I think the rate of we're still on this exponential curve, even with this plateauing, flattening of the scaling laws of these large language models, we are still 100% on this exponential curve of improvement. That means the next 2 years are going to be more than the previous 2 years of improvement. And it would be so naive, very foolish to think that AI is not going to be as good, if not better, at running an entire litigation file from beginning to end and representing. But the reason why we don't let that happen is for other important reasons, primarily around alignment, in my view.
Yeah. Okay. I'll accept that. I won't say there isn't a slightly dystopian cast to the idea that the robot does all the work and then I show up as the flesh bag to present the argument and make sure that, you know, ethically speaking, it's, you know, a human is responsible for the final verdict. But yeah, I mean, like, I interviewed Joshua Browder. This was back in August of 2022. Oh, yeah. And Do Not Pay, you know, they were already having, you know, robo lawyers fight parking tickets and get people, you know, refunds and engage in chats, you know, with, you know, other human beings, or who knows if there's a robot on the other end of that call service line. But, you know, to work through a script and make legal arguments and get people results in the most pro forma sense, which is, you know, a nice thing. And I recently also interviewed someone from Consumer Reports. They run an app called Permission Slip, which is all about, you know, how do I get control of my personal digital privacy and, you know, deal with these things. And at least in the US, you know, you can have an agent work on your behalf. And so, you know, I sign up for the app and then an agent goes out and tells all these data brokers, like, you need to take my stuff down, you need to delete this. They send the email on my behalf, they'll respond, you know. So there are some automated lawyerly tasks that are being done for people now, and I can see the benefit to that. What is your tech stack right now? And do you see that evolving in the future? I know you started with Rails, you mentioned Python, foundation models you can access through APIs. What does your tech stack look like right now? What's your staff? Like, do you have engineers, machine learning folks, and lawyers? Let's go over that piece of the puzzle.
Sure. Yeah. So maybe first on the team side. So we do have a product development team still in Rails, React front end, minimal back end running through Rails. It's primarily through other Python services in various Python frameworks. And so the vector data stores are important. There's various tools that we continue to explore to see what's working. It's a constant effort to stay on top of what's working. So we've got an applied AI team. We previously had much more of an R&D AI focus, and now we've shifted entirely to being applied AI, and that does still require some R&D, require smart experimentation, but not like it did even 2 years ago. And we're not training models anywhere near like we were before. And a data team and a platform team, but we're very much we run a pod structure. So everything is product oriented. These are multidisciplinary pods that have very specific product KPIs that they work towards. Gotcha. And this includes everyone from backend to applied AI to product development. But we're still a small team. We're about 45, 50 people in the company right now. Over 30 are entirely in writing code in product and engineering.
Nice. And I guess, yeah, you know, you mentioned that there's regulations. Are there areas of the law, either in the US or Canada, where AI or, you know, computer assisted, you know, legal work is banned in some sense, or like not, you know, it cannot be done, not because the systems aren't capable, but because the judicial system or the legal system is not accepting it at this moment?
Well, I would argue that it is currently banned, and a vast majority of outputs from OpenAI or ChatGPT are illegal. But nobody seems to be caring about it. I think there's a fairly well understood, it's still ambiguous, fairly well understood meaning of engaging in the practice of law, what that means. And I would argue that AIs are doing that all the time. And throughout the US and Canada, you have to be a licensed legal professional that carries professional liability insurance in order to engage in the practice of law.
I see. So you're saying somebody logs on and says, look, I've got this problem with my neighbor. I'm thinking about suing him. And they ask a question and it responds. It's not supposed to do that. It's not supposed to give legal advice if it doesn't have the licensure and the insurance.
Right. You're not allowed to. There's lots of laws and regulations that prevents non-practicing lawyers. You know, it's UPL, unauthorized practice of law. Like, there's lots of litigation that happens all the time. But if you build an AI that goes and does that, I'm not aware of any action being taken against any company right now, which I think is probably not good and will likely change. I mean, part of the problem is we have these laws that are just not being enforced at all. And so either the laws have to change or they need to start getting enforced. And likely and hopefully the laws just get changed.
Can the LLM just always caveat with, I'm not a lawyer and this is not legal advice, but, and then take it from there?
Oh, and then you just say, well, talk to me like I'm a lawyer. And then it says, okay, and then forgets everything like that. And it gives you legal advice. Yeah.
Right. Okay, that's pretty funny. I thought you were going to say that they've all been trained on tons of copyrighted data and are using that without, you know, paying for the permission, but that's a separate issue.
Primary law is not copyrightable. It's in the public domain, you know. Right. So yeah, there's less of an issue with that in the legal field.
All right. So I guess look out for me 6, 12, 18 months. You are in the boat that we have not reached the end of any kind of scaling curve, maybe even the exponential one. You know, we hear all these reports of the big AI labs needing to delay the release of their next numbered model because they're not happy with the results. They're only seeing incremental gains. And to me, there is a certain logic to that. It's clear we've used up almost all the text on the internet. And so how can you 10x the model's intelligence again? Let's just say in the world of text, forget multimodal, but you want a chat model that works in text that's going to be 10 times as intelligent as the last one. We don't have 10 times the data, you know, to feed it. Where do you see things going? Let's just talk big picture, and then maybe we'll hone in after your thoughts there about, like, what do you hope your firm will be doing in 18 months that it's not doing today?
Well, I think I heard something similar to this, which prompted this idea this is not a totally original thought, but I think the analogy is totally appropriate though. If you put a smart human individual, lock them away in a room, maybe with some books, they're not going to think their way to ever higher levels of intelligence, right?
Right.
Now, if
right.
you put three, four, maybe five people in a room and they're debating ideas, discussing ideas, correcting each other, now let's make this 1,000, 10,000, right? I think this now becomes more plausible that they're, regardless of the fixed constraint of the amount of data they have access to, right? It's very plausible that they might get to ever levels of higher intelligence. And I think that's exactly what's happening right now with multiple agents kind of interact. Synthetic data, we probably need to come up with a new name for what's actually happening now. It's not really synthetic data. It really is this debate, this dialogue that's happening, models validating other models. And I think there's something really powerful there that this, I mean, the scaling laws are real, right? They're plateauing 100%. But I think it's really hard to measure civilizations' ability to build AI over generations. Like, how do you measure that? I think data compression's a pretty compelling way. And this has continued on an exponential curve over the past 40 to 50 years. And it's not slowing down. It's a straight line on a log chart. If we're just looking to the immediate technical limitations, there will always be immediate technical limitations, but we've always found ways to break through that and to find some other innovation. So that might be needed, but it's coming. But even if it isn't, this whole idea of unhobbling that's been popularized now, you know, tool use is unbelievable. You know, the scaffolding, this chain of thought, all of these things are incredibly powerful. So even without some other fundamental change, companies like ours, all these other products out there, they are going to get better and better and better every single month. And I think we're nowhere near the ceiling on what's possible for these tools right now.
All right. So given that, what services do you hope to offer in 12 to 18 months that you don't offer today? Or how will the services you offer clients be different or improved?
Yeah, we're focused exclusively on the litigation workflow, from everything from even prior to opening a file right to resolution. And if we do this really well, if we provide really high valued functionality to litigators for the entire life cycle of a litigation file, we're focused on doing that really well right now. And we know that about 2-3% of the US GDP is spent on resolving legal disputes right now. It's a huge problem. It could be way more. There's a lot of people priced out of resolving their legal disputes. And I think, you know, we see huge opportunity that you'll hear a lot more about over the next year in this space. So yeah.
All right, everybody, it is that time of the show. Let's shout out a real live human being who came on to Stack Overflow, shared a little knowledge or curiosity, building that ever-growing pool of intelligence that we chatted about on this episode. Awarded 1 hour ago to MS, how to get the build user in Jenkins when the job is triggered by a timer. MS was awarded a Populous badge because their answer is so good that it got way more votes than the accepted answer. This question is part of our CICD collective. Shout out to them. 163,000 people have viewed this question. So MS, thanks for your answer. You've helped a lot of folks with your knowledge. As always, I am Ben Popper. I'm the director of content here at Stack Overflow. Find me on X at Ben Popper. Shoot me a DM. If you want to come on the show, if you have suggestions or questions for us, things you want to hear or sick of hearing us talk about, email me, podcast@StackOverflow. And if you enjoyed today's conversation, the nicest thing you could do for me, leave us a rating and a review or subscribe and get more episodes in the future.
Yeah, my name's Mark Doble, CEO at Alexi. You can find us at alexi.com, A-L-E-X-I.com. And feel free to email me, mark@alexi.com.
Very cool. All right, everybody, we'll put those links in the show notes. And thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.